Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Ian McGilchrist, a patron of the Middle Way Society and author of The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World. Ian, welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Now, quite a few of our members already know something of your work. Indeed, people have come to the site through the ideas we've adopted from your book. But for those who are not yet familiar, could you give them a bit of an overview of The Master and His Emissary?
Yes, well, I'll try to. The book tackles the otherwise unfashionable idea that there might be real differences between the two hemispheres of the brain. In fact, it's fairly obvious that there are going to be differences because the brain, an organ which exists only to make connections, has this enormous division in the middle, which over the course of evolution we could have got rid of, but nonetheless it has, if anything, got more pronounced rather than less so. And the two brain hemispheres are asymmetrical in just about every respect that one can imagine. Mm-hmm. And it's well known to neurologists and psychiatrists that depending on which hemisphere of the brain you have a lesion in, something quite different happens to the world of the individual concerned. So it's not a rational position that there would be no difference, but I think a lot of scientists have been saying something like that because all the ideas we used to have that, you know, the left hemisphere was to do with reason and language and the right to do with emotion and imagery has turned out to be wrong.
Okay.
In fact, both hemispheres are involved in everything, so we know that. So the question was really what kind of a difference there was. And it turns out that although there's not a difference exactly in what the brain hemispheres concern themselves with, as I say, they both concern themselves with everything, they do so in a different manner, a consistently different manner between the left and the right hemisphere. And this is continuous with differences that are also present in animals and birds.
Uh-huh.
And these differences seem to exist for a Darwinian reason. They help us survive. And in brief, we need to pay two kinds of attention to the world at once. One is a kind of very narrowly focused, precise attention that enables us to interact precisely with elements in the environment, in other words, to grab things for our use, to grasp something for food or pick up a twig for shelter or whatever it is. But this is a very sort of narrow kind of attention, and if it was the only kind of attention we were paying, we wouldn't last long, because while we're doing that, we need also to be paying the entirely opposite kind of attention at the same time, so a sort of broad, open vigilance for whatever there might be without any preconception.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a difficult thing to do in one consciousness that we have evolved two conscious centers, if you like, both of them focused on the world and both of them therefore dealing with everything, but dealing with them in these two different ways or with two different kinds of attention. And essentially the right hemisphere is the one that sort of grounds our experience, but the left hemisphere can offer interesting unpacking of detail when that's deemed necessary. And this can add very much to what we know about the world. But then that knowledge of details needs to be put back into a whole picture in order for it to be useful or to make any kind of sense.
Yeah.
So we need both of these hemispheres, and if you like, the right hemisphere is the one that sees the big picture and helps us understand the world, and the left is the one that sort of sees details and helps us interact with it. And my belief is that over time, we've come to favor the take on the world, if you like, offered by the left hemisphere. And what I don't mean is that, you know, our brains have evolved in some way that would make them obviously different if we could inspect the brain of somebody in the 16th century and inspect the brain now. I don't think we'd see enormous differences.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really at all about that kind of thing. It's more that while we're living headlong, we're not aware that we're synthesizing these two views of the world. It would be not to our advantage if we were aware that we were alternating two different visions. That's definitely not a positive thing if you're running about trying to get on with life.
Yeah.
But when we stop and reflect on the world and think what sort of a thing the world is, what sort of thing a human being is and what our relationship is, then one has to choose in a way. And it's my view that a lot of the problems in philosophy hinge on whether you are adopting the more left hemisphere view, in which little bits which are clear and static are put together to build up a whole picture gradually, or whether you adopt the right hemisphere's view, in which there are no precisely certain points, but everything is in fact connected and living and moving and changing, but at least you see a whole animate universe rather than a particulate and inanimate universe.
Yeah.
So those two ways of thinking about the world are not strictly speaking compatible, and as I say, when philosophers and theologians stop and speculate, they're going to run into the problem of which kind of a model they're following, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can become a way of thinking that characterizes a society. And I believe our society now is one in which the spokesmen, particularly from the sciences, but from all areas now, tend to favor the view of the world as something that can easily be known, provided we just stick to the solid points of information that are apparently immutable and certain. My own view is that nothing is immutable and nothing is certain.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I hope that helps give some idea of what the book's about. In the first part, I deal with the sort of neurophysiology and the philosophy of this. And in the second part, I take a look at the history of the West over the last 2,000 years and suggest that we've been through this cycle several times with the rise and fall of civilizations, that when they flourish, as in the 6th century BC in Greece or towards the end of the Republic in Rome, you can see evidence of both hemispheres offering enormously much and synergistically to a society, but that as that society progresses and becomes more powerful, things ossify, become hierarchical, become fixed, and begin to lose their life, and gradually the civilization decays. And I think we're in that phase of the modern era since the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was a wonderful movement, but I think things have offered us a lot, but unfortunately it thought it knew everything, and that's its mistake. It's always fatal to think that you know everything.
Yeah. So do you see a definite correlation then between psychological integration and integration of society?
Well, yes. I mean, in a way, what our individual brains offer us is a couple of takes, which a society is in its spokesman and in its thought leaders of thought are going to adopt one way or the other. The trouble is that in an era like ours where we prize consistency above everything, it's more likely that you'll aim for the left hemisphere's view because it's exclusive. It doesn't take into account what the right hemisphere knows. It just rules all that out as incompatible.
Right.
And just as, like, you know, when you come across something like consciousness, if you have a view that the entire universe is unconscious, then you just sort of claim, consciousness doesn't exist. Well, you know, I hope most of your listeners will sort of smell a rat when that when that sort of maneuver is carried out. The right hemisphere, on the other hand, is quite willing to accept that the left hemisphere has validity. So it's much more at ease with holding incompatibles together. That's a rather important point, actually, because, you know, in the past, people realize that sometimes a thing and its opposite, or things that are not compatible with it, might both be true. But in the modern era, we have come, I'm afraid, to rather simple-minded view that everything that exists must be compatible.
Yeah. This, in a way, alludes to the title. Could you just tell the listeners why you decided to use that title?
Oh, yes. Well, it comes from a hint in Nietzsche of a story about a spiritual master who looks after his people so well that they flourish and grow and so on. And after a while, he realizes that not only he cannot anymore look after all their needs, but what is rather more important, he shouldn't get involved in certain aspects if he's to maintain his overview on which their well-being depends. And so he appoints his sort of brightest and best right-hand man, so to speak, in this case the left hemisphere, to go about his business and do certain kinds of detailed work on his behalf. And this chap, being bright, you know, sort of realizes that he knows a lot, but unfortunately what he doesn't know is that the master knows more than he does. And so it's that lack of knowledge about what it is one doesn't know that is fatal. And he thinks he's the master. He does all the hard work, and what does that master know? And he adopts the cloak as he goes about his business. He sort of says, I'm the master, and as a result, the domain sort of crumbles. And I suppose that's the story rather like the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a poem of Goethe's before it was made into a famous film.
Walt Disney. Yeah.
Yeah, Walt Disney, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great title, and it summarises the sort of idea really well.
Right, yes, good.
Yeah, and anyway, moving on, yeah. Now, you read English at Oxford and later became a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
How important was immersing yourself in those two quite diverse areas of interest with regard to your book?
Well, I think it was important in several ways. I actually think that when one's dealing with the human, as doctors and particularly psychiatrists are, a background in the humanities is a very good idea. It stops one from naively believing that we are machines. In the way that a lot of doctors assume automatically we are. And I think also it gave me a context in which to set the information I had. I've always had a big interest in philosophy. In fact, I originally was going to study philosophy and theology at Oxford, but then did English and then went back to philosophy and psychology after I got my degree.
Okay. Now, Robert Ellis made the observation that often people who are drawn to this understanding of how the brain works are often sort of jacks of all trades or polymaths. Do you think there's something in that?
Well, I think it helps, you know, if we're going to see the overview, to have a grounding in something that gives a context or a deeper background into which to set the information that one gets as a scientist. And it's now become so specialized study of the brain that there are journals devoted to every organelle and every receptor you can imagine in the brain.
Yeah.
So it's very highly specialized. And I'm afraid that in the way that one's normally chained in science, it's not often the case that you have the leisure to look at things in a cultural, philosophical context. And so knowing those things helps one not just to go beavering on deeper and deeper into a tinier and tinier furrow, but to sort of stand back and say, what does all this mean in terms of what the brain is and what a human being is? So I like that idea. I think it's probably correct.
Okay. So in that regard, would you say you're something of a polymath?
Well, I'd resist the term because, in fact, I'm all too aware of my ignorance. And I suppose, you know, polymath makes one sound as though one knows an enormous amount. And I don't feel I do, but I've certainly always been interested in everything.
Right.
And my career has tended to zigzag back across the sort of borders between humanities and science.
All right. So would you say you're a very curious person?
Yes, I like that.
Okay. So what is your understanding of the value of the arts in relation to these ideas?
Well, in a way, that's similar to what I was saying. That I think that the arts require one to become aware of a different way of knowing.
Yeah.
And we can assume that knowledge means the accumulation of facts, but in fact, the accumulation of facts doesn't constitute any kind of knowledge. It's merely information. And for it to be knowledge, one has to really understand what this means. And I think the arts introduce one to the idea that a lot of the most powerful things, things that can move you profoundly, can mean very much to you, can change your life, are not easily summable up in a few words or bits of information.
Yeah.
So they open one's mind to the idea that there is an element that is much less under our control, in a way rather mysterious and awe-inspiring, which is one very important aspect of how we know or understand anything at all.
Mm. Well, there was actually a question from one of our members about awe. She's about halfway through your book, and she's not sure that that you address that. It sounds like you have. Do you have any thoughts on that, especially in regard to a stimulus such as music?
Yes, I do. And I mean, your listener will find that I do talk about awe, both as the origin of philosophy and the proper end of philosophy, in fact. Not to pat ourselves on the back and say what clever chaps we are now, we understand everything, but actually to increase our awe. And also in relation to the 18th century, where I talk about romanticism and so on. But it is an element in religion, a religious understanding, and as you say, it is an element in the profound way in which the arts work, and I would agree that music is often expressive of a kind of awe and induces a kind of awe.
Yeah.
And I think that awe is a terribly important thing. The sense of wonder or awe, I think if one loses it, one's pretty much dead.
Mm.
And somebody wrote to me asking for, you know, the one thing that I would recommend to people to sort of make sure that they're awake or alive or whatever. And I think my answer to that would be to question oneself every day as to what has been awe-inspiring and what is awe-inspiring in one's world, and just be aware of it. And
yeah.
If one finds the answer is nothing, then one needs to change the way one's living and thinking.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting bit of advice, that. Yeah. Another contributor, Richard Flanagan, would be interested to hear what you might say about the intention behind art and if this affects the value and the difference, if any, between traditional art, vandalism, graffiti and street art.
Gosh, there's a lot, isn't there? Well, intention, of course, is altogether a very conscious concept that one has approaches the world with intention. There are certainly areas in art where people historically at certain periods have had more or less formed intentions, but I think that the important part is the stuff that one doesn't altogether intend, because one doesn't really know it until it actually comes about. I think having an intent, too much of an intention, is an impediment. A lot of modern art rather earnestly requires an explanation. You go to an art gallery and there's a screed beside the rather puzzling-looking pile of trash or whatever it might be that tells you what was in the mind of the artist when it was created. And you might go to a concert and hear the first performance of a piece of music, which apparently can't speak for itself, because one needs a sort of spiel beforehand about how the composer was thinking and what he or she intended.
Yeah.
I think this is a thoroughly retrograde step. I mean, none of the great work, I really do not need to have that information when approaching Bach or great painting or whatever it might be as a past. I'm sure there is graffiti that raises itself to the elements of, you know, to the level of a kind of art form, and I suppose Banksy is the classic example of that.
Yep.
But I don't think that, on the whole, graffiti, can be compared. And I find it rather sad that so much modern art naturally allies itself with the ugly, the destructive, the defacing, the aggressive, and rather obviously intended, and that opening ourselves to something deeper and that can't be easily articulated would be a better move.
Okay. Well, this ties in a little bit to my next question. What's your view of modernity?
Well, I give it really in the chapter on modernism and postmodernism in the book. I think it exemplifies the way the world looks, you know, if we adopt the left hemisphere's point of view.
Yeah.
I sort of switched on to this idea in a very exciting moment when I picked up in 1992 a book called Madness and Modernism by Louis Sass, S-A-S-S, which I very much recommend to all your readers, which is written by an American psychologist, a very distinguished psychologist who's also well-versed in culture generally and philosophy. And the point that he makes is that there are extraordinary and remarkable overlaps between the way schizophrenia makes the world look and the way modern art makes it look. And these are rather hard to dismiss. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the link that I made was that, in fact, in schizophrenia, what happens is that people don't seem to be able to use the faculties we normally associate with the right hemisphere.
Right.
And it's almost like a world in which the left hemisphere has gone into a pathological overdrive and the right hemisphere is just not contributing.
Uh-huh.
So that's not to say that actually, you know, if you look at the brain of a schizophrenic, you're going to find that their right hemisphere is not active. In fact, because the brains of schizophrenic subjects are anomalously lateralized, you probably would find there is quite a lot going on in what looks like a right hemisphere that isn't behaving like one, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more complicated than just observing. But if I put it this way, if you wanted to sort of take a normal individual and create somebody who looked at the world rather like someone with schizophrenia, you'd put a lot of holes in their brain or in the right hemisphere.
Okay.
So in other words, the way the world looks now is rather like the way it would to the left hemisphere, piecemeal, fragmented, bizarre, lacking in meaning, alienating, and so forth.
Yeah, but do you think we've made moral progress, you know, compared to, say, 200 years ago?
Well, I know Thinker thinks we have.
Yeah.
I don't find myself usually aligning myself much with Stephen Pinker, although I admire his intellect. I don't know, really. You know, to say we've made moral progress is a difficult one. In certain respects, we've obviously adopted a much more tender-hearted view, and that can often result in good. There are certain obvious things that we're more tolerant of than we used to be.
Yeah.
But morality is a complicated thing.
Yeah.
And I very much myself adopt a view that Jonathan Haidt put forward in the book The Righteous Mind,
mm-hmm.
that we at the moment think of morality in very limited terms compared with the way people always have thought about morality at other times and still do in other cultures. And that, you know, our conception of what morality is too constrained.
Okay.
And so the answer is I pass on that one.
Okay. Okay. Just a quick question about religion. What are your views on that?
Well, I'm not a good church attender or anything like that, and I don't really see myself as being a very good follower of any particular one religious path.
Yeah.
But if there's one thing I do feel very clear about, it's the materialist conception of the world simply doesn't have all the answers, and
yeah.
that I think religion is the religious sense or the spiritual sense is a very, very important part of our humanity, and not just to be discounted as something sort of useful but misguided. I think it's probably alerting us to things that it would be wise for us not to dismiss.
Yeah.
And I think the religions have their value when they form ways of expressing this through ritual. We live in an age in which ritual is not much sort of highly thought of, but ritual is really embodied metaphor, and a lot of religious truths can only be expressed in such a way. So the bringing together of people who share a view and are prepared to go through certain rituals is rather a good thing.
Yep.
I'm afraid it doesn't translate into my being a good member of a congregation anywhere, but that's my view. I think the religion is not a left or right hemisphere matter. Like everything else, there's left hemisphere religion and there's right hemisphere religion. I would say right hemisphere religion is the sort of thing that one finds in the mystical tradition of religion. So, for example, Sufism in Islam and people like Meister Eckhart and the author of The Cloud of Unknowing in the Christian tradition. And there are sort of left hemisphere religious people who are the fundamentalists, the tub thumpers, those who know that they're right.
Yeah.
You know, as I say a couple of times in the book, the only thing one can be certain of is that those who believe they're certainly right are certainly wrong.
Yeah, I like that. Another question from one of our members. This is from Norma Smith.
Right.
She asks, If one is born, for example, with a more dominant left hemisphere due to inherited genes, etc., does the brain change or develop during a lifetime to become more dominant on the right or vice versa?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say would be that, you know, that it's not usually as simple as that one is either right-brained or left-brained in that sort of a way. So we're all a mixture, although we can, and I agree, possibly for genetic reasons, favour the way of thinking of one or other hemisphere. But I think one can change the way one is by adopting practices and opening one's mind to certain ways of thinking, and so one can guide one's own thought in one or other direction. So I think as life progresses and as one grows, one can. But I'm afraid this could mean solidifying into sort of stereotyped ways of thinking that would be more typical of the left hemisphere, as well as opening one's mind to ways in which it might be more sort of right hemisphere-like,
okay.
If I can put it that way.
Yep. Okay, and my final question, Ian. How do you feel your work relates to the middle way?
Well, I was very struck when I encountered Robert Ellis's work, and I did think that there were enormous overlaps there. I'm currently writing a book about the sort of rather paradoxical things that keep happening to us, if you like to see it that way. In other words, we think we're doing the right thing and setting about things, but because we've got a very simply polarized view that it's either this or it's that, we tend to end up with conclusions or in places which we never intended.
Yeah.
And so, I think a rather important point is that I don't think that whatever the middle way is, it's simply an average, as it were, or a sort of midpoint on a linear scale. You have to think in a non-linear way, as it being almost like something that's at right angles to the way we normally think.
Mm.
In other words, that might involve going in both directions, opposed as they might be, equally far, rather than sort of settling for... It doesn't mean a compromise.
No.
Although sometimes a compromise is a very mature, wise and sane thing.
That's been great, Ian. Well, thank you for talking to us today. It's been a pleasure.
Not at all. And thank you very much for inviting me to do so.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.